Chapter 6. I raised my drink to Hesperus, his gold face splintering into disorganized facets through the wine glass. He was sitting on the other side of the table, with Dr. Menix to his right and my fellow Shatterling to his left. "To you, Hesperus," I said, "to the safe recovery of your memories, to your reunion with the machine people, to the future, and to the good things we may accomplish as allies." "To Hesperus," Campion said, emptying half his glass in a single swig. Hesperus raised his own glass and nodded. He took a sip of the wine, enough to make it clear that he had really drunk it rather than just swirled it around in his mouth for appearance's sake. "Thank you. It is very good to feel that I am amongst friends. You have been most gracious hosts. All the same, if there's anything you need, anything we can do to make you more comfortable..." "There really is nothing," he told Campion, "save for the damage inflicted by Ateshka. I am in excellent working order. I am even beginning to recover some sense of my past." "It's coming back?" I asked. "Slowly. The damage is great, but my repair routines are efficient and well evolved."
"While we're on the subject of damage," Dr. Menix's avatar said, "I can't help noticing that arm of yours."
"My arm, Doctor?"
"Yes, the left one. The one that's conspicuously larger than the other. Or had that somehow escaped your attention?"
Hesperus shifted awkwardly, glancing at Campion and me in turn. "Does it trouble you, Doctor?"
The Harlequin flexed back in his seat. "Why should it trouble me?"
"Because you raised the matter."
"Only out of profound concern for your well-being."
"It is most kind of you to show that concern, but I assure you there is no reason for alarm. I have detected no abnormalities in my functioning."
We were in Campion's dining room, a few hundred meters aft of Dalliance's bridge. Fake windows made it appear as if we were in a kind of gondola suspended under the gentle curve of her hull. Campion had even turned on the fake stars, creating the illusion that we were flying through a blizzard of suns, with stars slamming by on either side of the dining room, occasionally accompanied by little whirling orreries of planets.
"All the same, it is rather odd," Dr. Menix persisted, "but we shall make no more of it. I have no wish to draw attention to your flaws. I am sure they are difficult enough to bear as it is."
"That is very considerate of you," said our robot guest.
After an uncomfortable silence, Campion said, "I'm sure we're all very curious to know what you've remembered, Hesperus. Did you get anything from the Trove entry on the Vigilance?"
Dr. Menix's avatar leaned in Hesperus's direction, creasing at the waist like a bent playing card.
"What possible interest would you have in the Vigilance?"
"He's got as much right to be interested in it as you have," I said.
"I shall bow to the Doctor's superior wisdom in this matter," Hesperus answered, acknowledging Menix with a microscopic nod. "All that I know of the Vigilance with any certainty is what I have gleaned from Campion's trove. That has been a most rewarding exercise, but I still cannot shake the sense that I had some prior interest in the matter."
"Could that have been the nature of your mission?" asked Campion.
"What mission?" I queried, before Dr. Menix could get a word in edgeways.
"That may be the case," Hesperus answered with a certain diffidence. I noticed that he was scratching the tip of his thumb against the glass of the wine goblet, the thumb blurring up and down almost too quickly to see, as if Hesperus was unaware of the gesture.
"All that I can say for certain is that, beneath the scrambled chaos of my memories, I feel a driving imperative, a sense of some vital task that I must complete, and which has not yet reached cessation. But I could be completely mistaken. Perhaps I was simply a tourist, ambling his way from site to site, with no greater goal than to accumulate memories and experience, much like yourselves, in fact."
"But if you do feel that driving imperative, maybe there's something to it," I said.
"I cannot deny a sense of restlessness, as if I have delayed long enough."
He ceased scratching the glass with his thumb and tilted it gently, swilling the wine inside it, mesmerized for a few moments by the play of light and fluid, as if it was the single most fascinating thing in the universe.
"One can only trust that being reunited with my fellows will help quieten my concerns. In the meantime, your hospitality is the finest I could hope for.
He raised the glass. Another toast, I think, to the prosperity and longevity of Gentian line. Long may it endure.
Campion and I reciprocated with our glasses, chinking them together above the table. I looked sternly at Dr. Menninx until he followed suit.
I hope you'll enjoy the Thousand Nights, I said. I don't know how this reunion will compare with others we've held, but I can more or less guarantee that you won't find a better one hosted by any other line. We've always thrown the best parties.
Will you enter abeyance shortly? Hesperus asked.
Campion and I have a little groundwork to cover before we can sleep.
They have stories to fabricate,
Dr. Menning said with unconcealed delight.
Strands to edit, memories to delete, others to falsify, all to play down the extent to which they have consorted. Of course, I know the full and sordid truth, rendering the exercise rather pointless.
And we know you're a disavower, I said. Keep that in mind before you start blabbing the rest of our line. You might find the reception turns a bit frosty when everyone gets wind of what a nasty, bigoted creature you really are.
The doctor makes it sound worse than it is, Campion said, smiling fiercely. We're not trying to create false alibis here. We're just moving some facts around. It's probably a pointless exercise, but if we can keep it down to one or two brief encounters, maybe we'll get away with the line's equivalent of a large slap on the wrists.
Does this not create risks?
Absolutely, Campion said, but what choice do we have?
When you delete a memory from a strand, from the public record, so to speak, what happens to the memory you retain in your head? Must it also be deleted?
No, I said, ignoring the awkward look Campion was sending me. We don't delete those memories, although we certainly could if we wanted. The process is easy enough. As a matter of fact, Campion thinks we would be on safer ground if we did.
I am sorry, Hesperus said. I did not wish to steer the conversation in an uncomfortable direction.
It's all right, I replied, sighing.
Look, Campion and I agree on 99 things out of 100. But the one thing we don't agree on, all right, one of the several things, is what we do with those memories that don't fit the story. I say we keep them. Campion says delete them, so that we never give Fescue or Bettany or any of the others anything to use against us. And damn it, I see his point. However, I just don't think that an experience is worth anything unless you can remember it afterwards.
I gazed down into the bottom of my glass, empty now.
To see something marvellous with your own eyes, that's wonderful enough. But when two of you see it, two of you together, holding hands, holding each other close, knowing that you'll both have that memory for the rest of your lives, but that each of you will only ever hold an incomplete half of it, and that it won't ever really exist as a whole until you're together, talking or thinking about that moment. That's worth more than 1 plus 1. It's worth 4 or 8 or some number so large we can't even imagine it. I think I'd rather die than lose those memories.
I find your convictions admirable. I did not know the value of memory until I lost mine.
I think I need to adjust my tank chemistry, said Dr. Menninx. All of a sudden I feel nauseous.
I would be more than happy to come down and adjust your tank chemistry, Hesperus said.
He threatened me, shrieked the paper cutout. Did you both hear that? He threatened me.
Hesperus moved to stand up. I think it would be better if I retired. It is clear that Dr. Menninx cannot see beyond the ghoulish figments of his imagination. It is a shame, since I have found this conversation to be most stimulating.
Really? I asked.
Very much so. Only a little while ago, while we were discussing the origin of my people and the hypothetical nature of my mission, something popped quite unbidden into my head. I cannot help but feel it is a memory of more than average significance. I hope you will not mind what I have done.
Mind what? I asked.
Hesperus held up his goblet and rotated it slowly, so that the side that had been facing him came into clear view. Engraved into the glass was a tiny, densely detailed design. Even across the table, the intricacy of the picture was astonishing, its lines as bright and thin as laser burns. I thought back to the way he had been scratching the tip of his thumb against the goblet. As I replayed the memory, I thought I could see him rotating the glass very slowly and precisely with the other fingers,
using the thumb to scratch out a two-dimensional image in a series of precise vertical raster lines. While he had been doing that, we had appeared to have his full and undivided attention. "Would it inconvenience you awfully if I kept the glass?" Hesperus asked.
Chapter 7. I climbed the iron ladder up to the top of Dr. Menings's immersion tank. Beneath my feet, the grilled decking throbbed with the ceaseless labor of pumps and filtration systems. Under the grillwork was bottle-green glass, thick enough to afford only murky glimpses of the floating occupant. I moved forward to the front of the tank and knelt down. I unfastened toggles and folded back a section of decking on squealing hinges until it lay flat against another part, revealing an access cover in the top of the tank. Steadying myself so as not to topple over the side, I gave the cover a hefty anti-clockwise twist. After several rotations, I was able to swing it open away from me. Under the cover was a circular hole bored clean through the glass, which was as thick as my hand, and under the glass was dark, bubbling liquid. I adjusted my position until I could put my face into the hole and into the water. It was not actually water, I knew, but rather a blood-warm chemical concoction that not only supported Dr. Menings against gravity and allowed him to breathe, but also provided him with various nutrient functions, absorbed through his skin and those internal membranes with which it came into contact. My poorly focused eyes peered into that nutrient soup and made out something, a large dark form, barnacled in places, tapering at the front with the suggestive gleam of eyes set into trenches along the side of what I chose to think of as the head. They might not have been eyes at all, but rather some other highly specialized sensory organ, or maybe even just a functionless growth of some kind. I think I saw a limb or flipper emerging from his flanks, but since I was looking into even deeper darkness at that point, I could not be sure. With my face submerged to the ears, I said, "I'm here. What is it you so badly needed to tell me in person, Doctor?"
"It concerns Hesperus."
His voice was a gurgling rumble that I could just about understand.
"What else?"
I pulled my face out and sneezed, then pushed it back into the broth again. "What's he done to annoy you now?"
"I found out something about him. It was by accident, but my intentions were good. I wished to discuss something with him, to soothe the troubled waters between us."
"I can just see you soothing troubled waters, Doctor."
"Believe what you will. I know only that I wish to establish some common ground, so that we could at least be civil to each other during the rest of the journey. I made my way to the cabin you've given him. Have you ever visited him in his cabin, Campion?"
"Now and then. Why?"
"Have you announced your intention before arriving? Have you told him to expect a visit?"
I had to sneeze and pinch my nose again before I could answer. I kept my eyes shut now as his fluid was starting to irritate them. "Can't say I remember either way."
"If you were to attempt to surprise him, I don't think you'd succeed. His senses are more acute than we give him credit for. I'm sure he knows when you're on your way by the cues you give off, the electrical field of your body, the noises you can't help making, the chemical signature of those 40,000 skin cells flaking off you every second you breathe."
"Your point being?"
"I don't give off those signals. I mean, my avatar doesn't. It's a machine, but not like him. I don't think he feels it even when it's near. He certainly doesn't hear it coming."
It was true. The avatar was silent as a ghost except when it spoke. Even then there was something whispery and spectral about it. "So you surprised him. What happened?"
"When I came through the door, which was not locked, he was seated at a table preoccupied with something. It was strange to see him like that, but I suppose tables are as useful to robots as they are to humans, especially if those robots take pains to make themselves look like men."
The water gurgled suddenly, as if Dr. Menix had drawn an especially deep breath.
"I could not see what he was doing. except that he had both arms on the table, and there were pieces of gold metal around them, curved parts, like the plates that make up his armor.
I had an uncomfortable feeling now. Go on.
I announced my arrival as politeness dictated. It was only then that he noticed I was there. Have you ever seen a machine startled, Campion? I advise you to experience it once for yourself. It's a very singular thing to witness.
I had to take my head out for several seconds now, wiping green scum from my cheeks, pushing lank hair back from my eyes. I'd be startled if you crept up on me, I said when I had returned to the fluid.
But would you have something you didn't want me to see? Hesperus did. In the instant he became aware of my presence, his arms moved with astonishing speed. They became a blur of gold. The metal pieces that were on the table vanished as if they had not existed. We both know what happened to them, of course.
Do we?
They were part of his armor. The casing for the left arm, I believe. The arm that is thicker than the other one, as if there is something under it, something he is hiding.
He's a robot. What could he possibly want to hide from us? That he's got machines and things under all that armor? Weapons? He is a weapon, Dr. Menninx. If he wanted to do something nasty to us, he could have done it already.
He was hiding something. I saw it.
You saw what he was hiding?
I saw that he was hiding something. What the thing was, I did not get a good look.
I knew he was lying, or unwilling to admit the truth to himself. He had seen something. He just did not wish to look foolish by saying it aloud.
Look, I said, trying to strike a reasonable note. It wouldn't make any sense for him to be hiding something inside that arm, would it? If he had something to conceal, he wouldn't draw attention to it by making one arm thicker than the other. He'd have made both arms the same size. That way we wouldn't have noticed anything odd about him.
But you admit it is peculiar.
I admit there's a puzzle, nothing more. For all we know, he was damaged and had to swap his old arm for one from a different robot, which is why they don't match.
They aren't robots in that sense, Campion. He's a machine at least as sophisticated as any ship you've ever seen. They can be any shape they wish. If he damaged part of himself, he could easily repair it so that it matched seamlessly with the rest of him. If he was forced to incorporate external parts, he could adapt those as well.
So perhaps we caught him halfway through a transformation. He got damaged, had to graft a new arm on, and now he's making it fit in better with the rest of him. That's what you caught him doing, tinkering with his arm.
Why would that startle him?
Because it's private. Neither of us has any idea what goes on in his head.
I do. Nothing at all is what goes on in there. Just a dumb computation, the endless shuffling of symbols.
In which case he can't very well have been startled, can he?
I'm not telling you this for my health, you know. He may not be conscious, but he can plot and scheme like a fox. He may just be following a program laid down thousands of years ago. But if that program instructs him to do something devious, something against your best interests, are you just going to pretend it can't happen?
What are you suggesting I do?
Confront him before it's too late. Find out what he really has under that armor.
You make it sound as if you're expecting to find a bomb.
I didn't see a bomb.
So what did you see, Doctor?
Skin, he said. Human skin, as I live and breathe.
That just isn't possible.
I know what I saw, Campion. Your guest is not what he claims to be. The only remaining question is, what are you going to do about it?
Chapter 8. Campion whisked over to Silver Wings of Morning and told me what he had just learned from the aquatic. I had my doubts about the doctor's reliability as a witness, but I knew that we would have no choice but to challenge Hesperus.
My heart was rising in my throat as we whisked back to Dalliance, thinking of the confrontation ahead of us. As it happened, Hesperus spared us the worst of it. He was waiting when we emerged from the whisking chamber, as if we had always had this appointment. "Were you on your way over to see me?" I asked, trying to sound as natural as possible.
"I would have crossed over if you had not come."
He stood at the door, his arms hanging at his sides.
"I hope you would not have minded."
"Of course not," I said. "There is something I feel I must bring to your attention." Hesperus looked at Campion and me in turn. I should have disclosed it sooner, but I confess I did not know quite what to make of the matter. I hope you will not be distressed.
Distressed, Hesperus? Why? I asked.
Campion coughed lightly. Actually, there's something we wanted to discuss with you.
Is it my arm?
Campion glanced at me, as if I was expected to be taking the lead, even though it was him who had come to me with this information.
"Tell him,"
I whispered. "We were wondering," Campion began.
"I presume Dr. Mennings brought it to your attention?"
Though neither of us spoke or gave any visible reaction I was aware of, Hesperus still nodded as if we had answered in the affirmative.
"I feared as much. I could not be certain that he had seen enough to raise suspicions, but I realize now that he must have. I do not blame him for talking to you. In his shoes, I would have had similar fears. He could have spoken to me directly, of course."
"Dr. Mennings was a bit taken aback," Campion said. "What did you want to tell us?" I asked.
"The same thing you wish to know. What is the matter with my arm?"
Campion said, "Dr. Mennings saw you examining something, but he couldn't tell what it was."
"It must have been rather distressing for him, as it was for me," Hesperus replied.
"For you?" I asked.
"I was as surprised by my discovery as Dr. Mennings. Even now, I do not quite know what to make of it."
The metal mask of his face had composed itself into a calm, watchful expression, as if Hesperus had already surrendered to his fate.
"Would you like to see what lies under the skin of my arm? The plating is only loosely attached."
Before waiting to hear what Campion and I might have to say in reply, Hesperus bent his left arm at the elbow and took hold of a section of plating with his right hand. It came loose and clattered to the floor. He removed another piece and another, until only the hand remained covered. Then he took hold of the hand and tugged the jointed gauntlet away, as if he had removed a glove. From the elbow to the tips of his fingers, his forearm appeared to be completely human. It was muscular and masculine, covered in dark skin and a luster of sweat. The skin on his palm and on the underside of his fingers was slightly paler. As he rotated the arm for our inspection, flexing the fingers, I could see the hairs on the back of his hand, the cuticles of his fingernails, the veins under the skin.
"It is as real as it appears," Hesperus said, while we said nothing at all. "It is human skin over human musculature."
Slowly and deliberately, he scratched the thumb of his right hand against the wrist of his organic arm, drawing a bead of blood.
"It bleeds, and heals, too. That is what I was ascertaining when I was disturbed by Dr. Mennings. I had scratched it a day earlier and was intent on gauging the degree to which the wound had repaired itself."
Campion was the first to say anything. "You talk as if you don't know what that thing is."
"Did I not tell you that I was surprised by my discovery?"
"How could you not know why that arm's the way it is?"
"I already told you that I know next to nothing about myself. It is a miracle that I even remember my name. Do you imagine I was intent on concealing this from you?"
"But you did conceal it," Campion said.
"Only because I wished to understand it before I brought it to your attention. From the moment I regained movement, I was troubled by the mismatch between my arms. I tried to peer through the plating, but I am opaque to my own sensors. Eventually I steeled myself to remove some of that plating, so that I might glimpse the mystery for myself.
At first I could not believe. It was the first time I had heard him falter. I hope you will not be offended when I say that I was disgusted at what had been done to me. Not because I am repelled by the organic, but because the organic has no place inside me.
You, I think, would be rightly repelled were you to wake up and scratch your own skin, and find the gleam of metal beneath it. Yet I convinced myself that there must be a rational explanation for it, one that would satisfy you as well. Hesperus lowered the arm slowly. But there is none. I can offer no explanation for the arm's presence. Could you have been damaged? I asked. Maybe you lost the original arm, and the only replacement available was from a human cadaver. You grafted it on until you could be repaired properly, and then forgot about the accident. We would never have cause to do such a thing. Were I to lose my arm, I could repair myself in short order, provided I was given access to the necessary raw materials. Metals, plastic, aspic of machines. If raw materials were not in abundance, I could allocate enough of my existing mass to effect the repair with little impairment to my functioning. I would not need to grub around cadavers. So Ateshka did it, not you, Campion said. He damaged you and then fixed you up with an organic part, not knowing you could repair yourself. I wish that could be the explanation, but unfortunately I know it cannot. The arm is an integral part of me. Once the casing was removed, I was able to peer deeper into the structure. I established that beneath the flesh and muscle is essentially the same mechanical skeleton you would find inside my other arm. He flexed his fingers again. I could still do great harm, if that was my intention. True, the skeleton has been modified to mimic the architecture of human bone and form a support matrix for the organic outgrowth. It has also been augmented with devices whose function I cannot elucidate, but which appear to supply the organic components with the chemicals they need to stay alive. What are you saying? I asked. That the arm was grown deliberately from the inside out. I see no other explanation, Purslane. I have already told you that I am capable of repairing myself. It is also true that it would be within my capabilities to grow this arm. Why would you have done that? I asked. Hesperus looked sad. Now we enter the realm of speculation, I am afraid. If I could give you an honest and unambiguous answer, I would not hesitate to do so. But I can only draw the same conclusions as you. Could someone have forced this transformation on you? Campion asked. Coerced you to do it for some reason or another? One struggles to imagine why. One also struggles to imagine any circumstances under which I might be coerced to do anything. You can understand why I'd much prefer it if you had been coerced. Because if coercion was not involved, then the transformation can be presumed to have taken place voluntarily. Yes, that alternative had not escaped me. Hesperus looked with what appeared to be renewed revulsion at his arm. I should like it if I might be permitted to replace the metal casing. You're as upset by it as the rest of us, I said wonderingly. Dr. Menninx was right to be disturbed. You can hide it if you want, I replied, but I'm not upset by it. It's just another part of you. If it exists for a reason, even if we can't see it yet. Campion shot me a speak-for-yourself look. Hesperus slipped the glove back over his fingers, then knelt to recover the discarded gold plates. He snapped them into place with astonishing speed, as if anxious to rid himself of the view of that arm as quickly as possible. The arm soon looked as it had before, but now that I knew what was underneath it, I could only think of that skin and muscle trying to force their way through the metal. What now? Campion asked quietly. Hesperus and Dr. Menninx still need to clear the air between them. I looked around warily, just in case one of the doctor's papery avatars had crept up on us while we were preoccupied. Seeing that we were alone, I smiled awkwardly. Campion can speak to him first, Hesperus. Then I suggest that Menninx pays a visit to your cabin and gets the story from the horse's mouth. Except there is no story, Hesperus said. Tell him what you've told us and he'll have no grounds for complaint. You came to us on your own, after all. That counts in your favor, as far as I'm concerned. If my presence is no longer desirable, I would be glad to return to the cage. No, that won't be necessary. Slowly, Campion held up a hand. Wait, let's not rush ahead of ourselves. We may not suspect Hesperus of any conscious wrongdoing, but that arm's still a cause for concern. Until Hesperus can explain it, until he can rationalize it. I'm not sure I'm exactly thrilled by the idea of him walking around. Maybe it wouldn't be such a bad idea for him to go back into the cage on a voluntary basis. I have no more intention of hurting you now than I did before I learned about the arm, Hesperus said.
I know. I believe you. But what if the arm has other ideas?
I shook my head disappointedly. It's a lump of meat, Campion. It can't act independently of Hesperus. Just because you're unnerved by it doesn't mean it's going to creep into your room and strangle you at night. He isn't going back into the cage. If you don't want him on Dalliance, he's more than welcome aboard Silverwings.
I didn't mean that.
That's what it sounded like. He's our guest, and we agreed to help him piece together the puzzle of his past. The arm's just another clue, that's all. I have no wish to cause a rift between you, Hesperus said.
Oh, this isn't a rift, I said haughtily. This is barely a tiff, not even on the radar.
Campion and I are agreed. You'll stay out of the cage. But since we're all going to be entering abeyance shortly anyway, the point is pretty much moot. You can switch yourself off, or whatever it is you do, can't you?
I can shut down my core functions, although housekeeping tasks will remain active.
He cast a sidelong glance at his now sheathed arm.
It is apparent to me now that I must keep the arm alive, which would not be possible were I to go into total shutdown. Starved of oxygen, it would begin to decay.
I nodded emphatically, trying to rid my mind of the idea of that arm turning into a rotten, gangrenous mass while it was still attached to him.
No, the arm has to stay alive. It's the only way we'll ever find out anything about it, or you, for that matter. I also suspect that the arm is a key to my true identity, or the true nature of my mission, Hesperus said. What I cannot grasp is why I made no effort to conceal the transformation by retaining perfect symmetry between my left and right sides. It is almost as if I had no need for subterfuge. The armor that encases the skin could almost be viewed as a barrier to protect it during growth.
We'll get to the bottom of it, I said, with more assurance than I really felt. If my years as a shatterling had taught me anything, it was that not all questions had answers. Societies had reduced themselves to radioactive dust because they could not accept that single unpalatable truth. Shatterlings were supposed to be a bit cleverer than that.
Chapter 9. It's not good, I said, after I had run every possibility through Dalliance's course plotter.
How not good? Purslane asked, leaning against a floating console, one foot tucked behind the other.
55 years. That's how late we're going to be. Even if you were to push Silverwings to the limit and leave me to make my own way there, you still wouldn't shave more than a year off that figure.
55 years does not sound so excessive when it has already been 200,000 years since your last reunion, Hesperus said, staring up at the huge map of the galaxy painted on my displayer, marked with the winding red line that showed our progress to date.
The details of this final part of our circuit, our stopover around the Centaur's world, our detour to Ateshka, and now the last sprint to the reunion, had been enlarged below the main image, since a few hundred light-years was barely a scratch against the vast territory we had already crossed.
Or am I mistaken?
No, you're not mistaken, I said. In any other situation, we wouldn't lose a wink of sleep over 50 years, or even 100. But you're not supposed to be this late for a reunion. No one ever shows up precisely at the agreed time, but most of the line members will have arrived within a year or two. There'll be a handful of stragglers who come in somewhere inside the first 5 years, and one or two who get there inside 10, but they'll be looked on sternly. Anyone showing up later than that will either have had prior dispensation to be late, or they'd better have a cast-iron excuse.
Which we don't, Purslane said.
You could not have been expected to anticipate Ateshka's treachery, said Hesperus.
No, but Ateshka didn't end up costing us all that much time. The mistake was placing too much faith in the Centaurs.
Purslane was giving me a dark look as she said this. I held up my hands in mock surrender. I admit it, all right, the horses were a bad idea. The point isn't to pick over my mistakes, but to see how we can make the best of a bad situation.
I'll get the Dr. Menning's business out of the way first. Let Fescue and the others have their pound of flesh. Then I'll wheel on Hesperus and show them what a good, industrious gentian I've been.
And me? Pislane asked. Do I get to share in any of your glory?
Only if you're prepared to admit we consorted. Otherwise it could get a little tricky.
They'll work out we consorted when we both show up late. No point even thinking of hiding that.
I suppose you've got a point there.
Pislane crossed her arms.
Yes, I do. So we'll both be taking credit for Hesperus. For my part, Hesperus said, I will speak well of you, and of everything you have done for me.
You'll have your work cut out by the time I've finished stating my manifold grievances, said Dr. Mennings.
You'll only have 1,000 days and nights, I said, so I'd get an early start if I were you.
The Avatar's expression turned furious.
You would do well not to mock me, Shatterling.
Mocking you was the furthest thing from my mind, Doctor. I clapped my hands cheerily. Now, the practical arrangements. Pislane and I will be entering abeyance as soon as we've finished editing our strands, which shouldn't require more than a day or so. Dr. Mennings, I presume you'll be putting yourself asleep until we reach the reunion system?
What I do in my tank is my own business.
All I was going to ask was, is there anything you would like Hesperus to keep his eye on while the rest of us are under?
Keep his eye on?
The Avatar asked with instant suspicion.
I will not be entering abeyance,
a golden guest informed the Avatar.
I have already volunteered to assist Campion by monitoring his other sleepers, ensuring that nothing untoward happens to them.
I would be happy to extend the same courtesy to you, Dr. Mennings.
You will do no such thing.
The Avatar looked at Campion with a mixture of indignation and real fear.
He must not come near my equipment, Shatterling. He has designs on it.
I have no designs on you or your equipment, Hesperus said. If I wished you harm, Dr. Mennings, you would already know it. I was only offering a kindness.
Campion raised a calming hand. Easy, Hesperus. I know you meant well, but from the doctor's point of view it would probably be better if you didn't interfere.
As you wish.
You're being very stupid, Pislane told the Avatar.
The stupidity lay in entrusting myself to Gentian Line. Everyone told me I'd be better off with the Marcelines.
Hesperus suddenly looked interested.
What exactly was it you wanted with the Vigilance?
Many and various things, none of which are of the slightest concern to you.
There's no reason not to tell us, I said.
You have never asked me before. Why now?
I don't know. Because Hesperus is curious. Because I never thought to ask you before. I'd had enough of the Vigilance on my last circuit. All I wanted to do was drop you off and get away from those giants as quickly as possible.
We shouldn't press Dr. Mennings, Pislane said. He's a scholar and entitled to his privacy.
She was using reverse psychology, knowing that our intellectually vain guest would not be able to resist the bait.
Well, if you insist on knowing,
the Avatar said, waiting a bit until it was certain it had our undivided attention,
the principal focus of my inquiries is the Andromeda Priors. In common with the Vigilance, I hold that the absence is the result of organized activity by alien sentience. Intentionally or otherwise, they have caused something to happen to their galaxy. As a sentient, resident in a similar spiral galaxy, I naturally have at least a passing curiosity concerning the event in question. If the Andromeda Priors did something foolish, then it is in our interests not to repeat that mistake. It is my strenuous conviction that the Vigilance has become too engrossed with the acquisition and cataloguing of data to take a step back and see what that data actually reveals. A lone scholar, dedicated to his task, might be able to see patterns, inferences, that the Vigilance has failed to detect. That was my hope. That is still my hope, in the unlikely event of my ever reaching my destination.
I share your concerns, Hesperus said.
Really?
The Avatar asked, sounding bored.
Really? I cannot deny that I felt a flicker of recognition from the moment the Vigilance was first mentioned. My conviction has only grown stronger since then.
Could it be that I was sent to this sector on a quest similar to your own?
To gather information on the Priors? Perslane asked.
Possibly. Or to learn something else known to the Vigilance.
Hesperus paused.
Might I ask you something, Dr. Meninx, from one lost scholar to another?
Ask away, the Avatar said idly.
Does the phrase House of Suns mean anything to you?
Something passed across the paper face, as quickly as the shadow of a cloud on a sunny day.
And if it did, the figure asked, I would ask what those words mean to you.
The words mean nothing. If they had some significance, I would have heard of them.
Where did you hear of the House of Suns?
Perslane asked. It sounds like a line, like the House of Flowers or the House of Moths. But there's no such line as the House of Suns. The golden face turned to address her.
It must have meant something to me once, but now I cannot say. All I am certain of is that the phrase is in some way related to the Vigilance. The two chime against each other, as if they once shared some obvious connection.
What did the Trove say? I said.
Nothing, which is to say, that phrase has occurred a great many times in a great many societies. But none of the instances appear to be the thing I am looking for. I think I would know it, if it were. There would be a sense of rediscovery.
The phrase means nothing, Dr. Meninx said.
Just because you haven't heard of it? Perslane asked.
It's immaterial. The Vigilance would never have entertained him anyway. They don't deal with machines. Machines bring the diseases of machines, the infections and parasites that infiltrate and corrupt archives, intentionally or otherwise. That is why machine people have always been forced to utilize human proxies in their affairs with the Vigilance. Is that not so, Hesperus?
Exactly so, Dr. Meninx.
Then I need hardly point out that your quest would have been futile. They would never have admitted one such as you into their data sanctums. You would have been better off staying in the Monoceros ring.
Unless this objection was already anticipated, Hesperus said, as if a thought was taking shape as he spoke. Could it be, Doctor, that the machine people required direct access to the Vigilance without the intercession of human proxies? Could it be that my mission was so sensitive that only I could view the archives?
You would still have been turned away, or dismantled.
Perhaps not.
Hesperus lifted up his left arm and removed the golden plating, exposing the organic forearm that had already caused Meninx so much distress.
It may be that you have solved the mystery, Doctor. When I left the Monoceros ring, my precise objective could not have been known to me, any more than you knew exactly what you would be doing when you originally left your home world. Later on, it must have become clear that it was necessary to consult the Vigilance. That was why I began to disguise myself, to assume the form of a biological human. I must have begun with this one limb as a proving exercise, to ensure that the work could be completed satisfactorily, before proceeding with the complete transformation.
Convenient supposition, Dr. Meninx said, but he did not sound completely sure of himself. Makes a kind of sense to me, I said. Hesperus did the one arm and then got waylaid by Ateshka before he could change the rest of himself. He wasn't disguising himself to blend in with the rest of humanity, but just to get past the Vigilance and through to their archives. Do you reckon it would have worked, Hesperus?
I suppose I must have been confident of success.
But there's so much of you you'd have had to conceal, Perslane said. You might have been able to look human, but I don't see how you'd have been able to pass any kind of examination.
Hesperus put the plating back on his forearm. I can only speculate that I had already given thought to this problem. Clearly, much of my existing cognitive volume would have been given over to biological componentry, muscle and sinew, requiring that I compress or discard certain faculties for the duration. My skeleton would have been mechanical and dense with processors, but it could also have been embedded with various devices capable of tricking scanning systems into thinking they were seeing bone and marrow. All the same, I would have been intensely vulnerable to both injury and detection.
The risk would not have been taken unless it was imperative to access that information.
If they'd found you out, Perslane said, there's no way the Vigilance would ever have dealt with the machines again, even via human proxies. You would have known that, and yet still considered it worth the risk.
It must have been something very, very important, Hesperus said, sounding amazed and doubtful at the same time, as if he did not quite believe he could ever have embarked on something so perilous.
You're playing into his hands, Dr. Menink said. Can't you see? He's latched on to the Vigilance because it allows him to explain away that arm. There's no other reason.
If I did not have an interest in the Vigilance, Hesperus answered patiently, what was I doing in that region of the Scutum Crook's arm?
He's got a point there, I said.
I've heard enough, the Avatar said, turning on its heels with a papery scuff. You are being manipulated, Shatterlings, manipulated and lied to. The sanest thing you could do now is to compel it back into its cage. Give Hesperus free roam of this ship, and I very much doubt that any of us will ever emerge from abeyance. I shall certainly not count my chances very highly.
When the Avatar had stalked away, Hesperus said, I am sorry to be the cause of so much disharmony. Perhaps the Doctor is correct. A great many things would be simpler if I were to return to the cage.
You're doing no such thing, I said.
Absolutely not, Perslane agreed. Menink can rot in his tank for all I care. I'm beginning to wish the Centaurs had let a few predators slip through their impasse when he went for that swim.
2 days later, Perslane and I made love, then parted. She whisked back over to Silver Wings of Morning, flashing across space in a heartbeat. She entered her cryophagus, while I entered my stasis cabinet, set the time compression dial and administered 2 eyedrops of synchromesh. She would dream as the machine cooled her body down to the edge of death. I would skip over the years in a few instants of subjective thought. My mind was searingly calm. We had forged our threads, creating 2 self-consistent narratives. We were going to be 55 years late, but we had survived another circuit, and we had a guest who was going to make everything all right for us. I thought of Perslane lying against me, wishing she was still there. Making love was a game of echoes. We had shared memory so many times that when I made love to her, I knew exactly how it felt to be Perslane. I could taste and feel her other lovers, and she could taste and feel mine, each experience reaching away like a reflection in a hall of mirrors, diminishing into a kind of carnal background radiation, a sea of sensuous experience. I had been a girl once, then 1,000 men and women and all their lovers. The stasis field locked on. The synchromesh took hold. I hurtled into my own future, while my ship ate space and time. Part 2. One day the little boy came again. I went up to the Belvedere and watched his shuttle arrive. This time I knew that we would spend the whole of the afternoon in Palatial, that no other toys mattered now. The anticipation induced a warm, glittery tingle in my belly. It was nearly a year since I had shown him into that secret world for the first time, and in the intervening visits it had come to dominate our imaginations like nothing else. By then I knew a little more about the boy, and where he came from. Like mine, his family had prospered in the conflagration, which was the name the adults gave the brief sharp war that had encompassed the golden hour in the 11th year of the new century. It had happened nearly 30 years earlier, but because my childhood had been dragged out across 3 decades by developmental inhibitors, I had some memory of it. I had been much too young to understand the nature of the thing itself, but I recalled a time when the adults talked in unusually low and strained voices, and when they could often be found walking in the halls with story cubes, cradling them like the skulls of dead friends, anxious for the latest scintilla of news or rumor. My family's specialization was biology, with a particular aptitude for the subtleties of human cloning. Cloning is a technology like making paper. It is not difficult if one knows how to do it, but extraordinarily tricky to invent from scratch, and fraught with pitfalls that may only be circumvented by a Byzantine arsenal of tricks and stratagems, many of which resemble the shamanic rituals of folk medicine.
The art was 1,000 years old, but there were still only a handful of practitioners who really understood it, and my family was one of them. Before the conflagration, when the opposed forces were rearming, we made armies of soldiers, squadrons of pilots. Our clones were famed for their loyalty, but also for their tactical intelligence and independent thought. They could function as autonomous units, lying low on the edge of the battle zone, activating as needed without direct control from the central authority. After the war, many of the survivors had been granted full citizenship rights. The little boy's family had supplied the armies and squadrons of the other side, but with machines, not organic beings. Sometimes they were controlled by human minds, but as often as not they had been given enough intelligence to function on their own. There were other heavy manufacturing concerns making battle machines, just as there were other cloning specialists. But we were the best at what we did, and his family was the best at making engines of war. Though there were tribunals, inquiries and sanctions in the years following the conflagration, both families came through them relatively unscathed and remained in business. The wheeled robots that came down the ramp with the little boy were not just his bodyguards, but were made by his own family. Their machines were everywhere now, more prevalent than they ever had been before the war. My family, having allied itself on the other side of the ideological schism between the organic and the mechanical, retained a healthy distrust of machines. As I have mentioned, for all its rambling vastness, there were few in the house. Most of the robots present were there to assist with the constant enlargement and reshaping of the house's basic architecture. Almost everything else was done by human servants or cloned nannies. "I know why it's called the Golden Hour now," I said to the little boy as we made our way through the house to the playroom and the waiting enchantment of Palatial. "Everyone knows that." "I bet you don't." Because he said nothing, I took that as license to continue. "It's because of light. Nothing can go any faster than it, including any message we send. That's all very well if you're on a planet or a moon. But after we moved into space, we got further and further apart. You couldn't have normal conversations anymore. It took too long for the words to get there and back. That's why you and I can't have a conversation unless we're together in the same house. Your home's on the other side of the sun right now. If I said, 'Hello,' I'd have to wait hours before you said hello back. Eventually, people realized that they didn't like being so far apart from each other. It made them feel lonely and cut off. They wanted to live in space because that meant they could do anything they wanted, but not be so spread out that it took hours to talk to each other. So they came up with the Golden Hour, which is where most of us live. The story cube says it's a torus around the sun, like a donut. It's an hour wide, as the speed of light goes. There are planets in it, and some moons, but also millions of lesser worlds, just like this one. If you're in the Golden Hour, the longest you'll usually have to wait for a reply will be 2 hours, and often it's a lot less than that. The story cube says it took nearly 10 centuries for human civilization to settle into this configuration. I liked long words, especially ones that the story cube had taught me, but that now we've found it, it'll be good for thousands of years, perhaps even tens of thousands. Don't you feel excited to be part of that? We could be friends forever and ever. I don't think so, the boy said dismissively. Father says it won't last. What won't last? The Golden Hour, of course. He says it's temporary. He says we'll eventually get bored with it and have another war, or find a way to go faster than light. Either way, it won't matter anymore. I felt I was ahead of him there. We won't leave. The story cube says there'd be no point. There's nothing beyond the solar system that we don't already know about, so what would be the sense in going there? We already have planets and moons to live on, and enough lesser worlds for everyone. I strived to sound earnest, even though I was reciting an argument that had been spoon-fed to me rather than one I had worked out for myself. Interstellar travel would be pointless, even if we could do it. And we can't. It's been done, the boy pointed out. People have already gone to Epsilon Indi and come back. That was just a stunt. It wasn't sustainable. And the people who did that went mad when they came back home. They couldn't adapt to the changes that had happened since they left.
Then they didn't go fast enough, but we can. Sooner or later, we'll even go faster than light. Father says it's just a matter of time, with all the research that's going on.
I rather doubt that.
Read something else in the story cube, have you, Abigail?
You can't go faster than light. It's just not possible.
Because you say so.
I answered huffily, because the story cube says so, and the story cube's always right.
Like it was right about the black hole under the house. You did look that up in the end, didn't you?
It's nothing to be frightened of.
Glug, glug, glug. The problem was, although I was as certain as I could be that I was right, I could offer nothing to bolster my arguments. I had read in the story cube that the speed of light was a universal limit. That in 1,000 years of experimentation, despite any number of false dawns, no one had ever managed to circumvent it. This had made me feel hemmed in and claustrophobic. It was like being told I must never run or skip down the long, dreary corridors of the house, but must walk instead, with my neck straight and my hands held behind my back. I felt affronted, as if the speed of light was a personal assault on my liberty. Why should I not go as fast as I pleased? Why should I not skip and run? But I could no more explain why the speed limit existed than I could explain why 2 and 2 did not make 5. It was simply the way things were. One of those rules, like the edict not to visit certain parts of the house, that were not to be questioned. But I sensed this was not an argument that would wash with the boy.
"I'll tell you why things can't go faster than light," he said, taking an impish delight in knowing more about the subject than I did. "Causality, that's why."
It was not a word I knew. I filed it away for later inquiry.
"Then you believe it as well," I said, hoping I would not be pressed.
"Father doesn't think so. He says causality's just a temporary stumbling block. It's the reason faster-than-light travel is difficult, not the reason it's impossible. One day we'll find a way around it, and then we'll all leave everyone else behind. They can keep their golden hour. It isn't going to be enough for the rest of us." Even though he was not being nice, even though he was teasing me, he was still my only true friend, the only one I really liked playing games with. The cloned companions the household sometimes sent me were too docile, too compliant, ever to compare with a real boy. When I won against them, I always knew it was because they had capitulated. It was never like that with my friend from the other side of the golden hour. When I beat him, it was because I was better. Typically, he would become friendlier to me, less argumentative the closer we got to the playroom. That was because his mind was shifting onto the matter of palatial. Without my consent, we could not enter it. He would tell me I looked pretty, that he liked the black ribbons in my hair. Palatial lived in a room of its own, inside the larger bounds of the playroom. It had been delivered and installed by green-overalled technicians. Now and then one of them would arrive to check on it again, usually bringing a box full of glistening maze-like panels, which he slid in and out of slots in the side of Palatial's casing. By then I knew that I was not the only girl in the world with this gift, but that it was one of a number of prototypes. I had been told that there were still teething problems with the game, which was why, despite it having been given to me a year earlier, Palatial had still not been authorized for mass production. It was nearly as large as the room it filled. On the outside it was a green cube, covered in mouldings depicting castles and palaces, knights and princesses, ponies and dragons and sea serpents. In one side was a doorway, leading through the thick-walled cube into its interior, where there was another room. The first time I had gone through that door, I had felt dizzy, and for a hallucinatory moment my thoughts had chased each other in epicycles of déjà vu. It was not as bad the second time, and by the third time I felt nothing as I passed through the aperture. Later I learned that the thick walls were dense with brain-scanning machinery, combing through my skull with invisible fingers. The boy experienced it the first time as well. I watched with a sadistic delight as the strangeness hit him, but he was also affected less and less with each subsequent visit. That was because Palatial kept a map of our minds in its memory and refined its scanning patterns accordingly. The room was empty, but it was also crammed with wonders and miracles. Appearing in the middle of the green-walled space, woven there by direct manipulation of our minds, was a palace.
It was perched on the top of an impossibly steep mountain, with a treacherous path winding its way up the mountain's sides, crossing gorges on bridges, spiralling through tunnels, leaning out from the cliff on outrageous ledges, before finally entering the palace by means of a glittering drawbridge. The palace climbed almost into the clouds, pale pink and pale blue like the icing on a birthday cake, sprouting turrets and towers, spires and keeps. It was the fabulous vertical counterpart to my own house, and from the instant I had seen it, I longed to know what was inside. Palatial made that possible. In fact, there was no escaping it. There were figures moving around behind the windows, on the ledges and turrets. Each was exquisitely real-looking, while glowing with a luminous stained-glass intensity, as if they were coloured drawings in a book with the light of day shining through the pages. I had seen animated figures in the story cube, but Palatial made even the best of those appear muddy and flat and dead. The little people in the palace were alive. They moved as if they had lives to be getting on with. On my first visit, I had noticed the princess, sitting on her own on the highest ledge, wearing a dress of blue fabric peppered with yellow stars, combing her long golden hair. Later, as I found her today, she was working with needle and thread on something in her lap. Even though she was no larger than a fingernail, and so far away from me that if she had been a picture in a book I would not have been able to read her expression, every detail on her face was clear to me. There was something very sad in her demeanour, some inexpressible longing, and yet I could not understand how anyone could live in a palace like that and not be radiantly happy. Palatial must have sensed this, must have sensed my interest in her, for all of a sudden I found that I had become the princess. I was sitting on the balcony wearing her dress, working with needle and thread, looking out across a fairy-tale landscape. It was not simply that my perceptions had been remapped to correspond to that tiny seated figure. I was actually inside her head, thinking her thoughts. In an instant, like the moment before waking when we confabulate an entire dream, I had access to all the memories of her life, back to when she was born in one of the highest, brightest rooms of the palace, on an early spring day when geese were crossing the sky from the north. I understood the history of her kingdom, the society into which she had been born, the difficult path she was about to tread upon ascension to the throne. I understood that her father, the king, had been killed during a battle with the neighbouring province. Although I had not noticed it until that moment, I spied on the horizon a dark counterpart to this palace, many leagues distant, wreathed in the shifting emanations of abnormal magic. I had become the princess, slipped into her world, but I was still Abigail Gentian, looking in from outside. I carried her memories, but my own were still present and correct. Shifting between the two, choosing to be the princess or Abigail, was a matter of adjusting mental focus. Palatial must have been helping me, because it soon became as easy as blinking. There was a knock on the door, gloved fist on heavy oak. I had been sewing the corner of an embroidered picture, my treasured sewing kit spread open on my lap. I put down the work and looked around. One of the palace guards entered, snapped his spurred heels against the stone floor and saluted. "Begging your pardon, m'lady, but a communication has arrived. The Chamberlain said I should bring it to you directly." "Very good, Lanius," I said. "Give it to me. I shall read it on the balcony. It is yet daylight." I had felt a compulsion to reply, as if I had been forced on stage in the middle of a drama and did not wish to let the audience down. Yet it was difficult to tell whether the words that came out of my mouth had been decided by me or shaped by Palatial. I had known the man's name without hesitating. I even had the vague sense that we had shared an adventure in the past, though not one that we cared to speak of now. I took the handwritten note, broke the wax seal and opened it wide. It was from my stepbrother, Count Mordax, in the Black Castle. My hands trembled as I read the devastating news. A raiding party of Mordax's had taken my lady-in-waiting prisoner. He was holding her even now in the Dungeon of Screams. In return for her release, he desired that I should reveal the identity of my uncle, the imperial wizard Calidris, who, having renounced sorcery, was now living as an ordinary man, a simple farrier, in one of the outlying hamlets of the kingdom.
"He wishes to use Calidris's magic for his own foul ends," I declared. "The very same magic that, even though wielded by a man of good heart, nearly tore our kingdom in two. I shall not give up my uncle's identity. Or do you think I must, for the sake of my lady-in-waiting?" As I spoke, I closed the sewing kit. I had used all but one of the needles in my embroidering. Only the smallest one, the blood-bound one, remained in its pocket. "I beg your lady's indulgence, but the master-at-arms has requested permission to ride out tonight into the very heart of the Count's territory. There is a detachment of Prince Araneus's men said to be camped in a clearing of the Forest of Shadows. With the help of those men, there is every chance of conquering the Black Castle." "Prince Araneus's men will want nothing of our squabble with Mordax. The prince has troubles of his own." "He remembers the good deed we did him in the Battle of the Seven Marches. If the prince has forgotten, his men will not have." "This has the stench of a trap, Linnaeus, or am I the only one who thinks so?" "It is right to be cautious, but if we are to act, it must be swiftly. The master-at-arms said he must reach the Forest of Shadows by sundown, or else his men will fall afoul of the enchantress at the Serpent Gate. I suppose I must speak to Cyrlus. He is with his men preparing their armor. Shall I summon him, my lady?" "No, I shall not interrupt his preparations unnecessarily. You will escort me to the armoring room, Linnaeus. Have Dorbenton summoned. On the way, we shall speak more of Count Mordax. No one is better equipped to understand my stepbrother's mind than you, I fear." Although I had become the princess, although I felt fully immersed in her life, I still remembered who I really was. It was like being in a lucid dream, with the consolation that I could wake up whenever I wanted to. Because of this, although there was excitement and jeopardy, there was no actual anxiety. I knew that it was just a game, and that nothing that happened in the green cube could really hurt me. The little boy had taken an immediate liking to it. By the time I revealed Palatial to him, I had become very comfortable in the princess's slippers. I could have slipped into the personality of any of the palace's protagonists, but I felt a loyalty to my flaxen-haired sister. "I'm her," I said, pointing to the figurines. "You can be anyone else, but not the princess." "Why would I want to be the princess anyway?" "I'm just saying." "Can you change to someone else once you've become one of them?" I nodded. "You just need to concentrate on it hard, willing yourself into the other person's head. But they have to be in the same room. If you're in a dungeon, you can't just become one of the guards outside and make them open the door." I had hopped from head to head, testing Palatial's rules, until returning to the mind of the princess. "And you can't keep changing all the time. You have to stick with each person until the game decides you've had enough. What is that other castle in the distance?" "The Black Castle, where Count Mordax lives. He's my stepbrother in Palatial." "I want to be him." "You can't. You can only be someone in the Palace of Clouds." "How do you know?" "You have to see someone to be them. Count Mordax is always too far away." Despite several attempts, the master-at-arms men had never succeeded in reaching the Black Castle. On that first night, the men camped in the Forest of Shadows had turned out to be soldiers from Count Mordax, dressed in the uniforms of Prince Araneus's army. They had ambushed our men and slain many of them. Master-at-arms Cyrlus had retreated, his attacking force in ruins. Though he had made two more attempts to storm the castle and liberate my lady-in-waiting, he had twice been repelled, with great losses to men and horses. Meanwhile, the agents of Count Mordax were scouring the hamlets and villages for the hidden sorcerer, Calidris. Soon Calidris would have to use magic just to conceal himself. "There must be a way for me to become Count Mordax," the boy said. "He's the baddie," I said, puzzled. "Why would you want to become him?" "He's the baddie to you, but I bet he doesn't think of himself that way." "He kidnapped my lady-in-waiting. He won't let her go until he finds out where Calidris is." "He asked me what I had done to free the lady-in-waiting. I told him about Calidris and the futile attempts to take the Black Castle." "Then you need to try something different. If I become Mordax, I could set her free, couldn't I?" I tried to tell him how Palatial would twist his mind once he was in it, to make him think and feel like Mordax. But it was difficult to explain. In any case,
He waved aside my point with feigned indifference. I still want to be him.
You can't. He won't come near the Palace of Clouds, and he won't let any of us near the Black Castle.
What about a messenger?
He'll kill you.
I shall ride as a spy and claim to have knowledge of the sorcerer. He won't kill me then, at least not until he's spoken to me. Then I can become him.
He might not see you in person.
Then I'll become his interrogator and work my way to him gradually.
I don't know, I said doubtfully. So far, palatial had been mine and no one else's.
When I played with it, the only other mind shaping the flow of events had been the dim but cunning intellect of the machine itself, working its way through endless schemata. If the little boy entered the game and took on the persona of Count Mordax, the landscape of my imagination would have changed. There would be another human mind affecting the outcome. It was one thing to be beaten by a machine, but I was not sure how I would take being beaten by another child. But I did so want him to share my secret world.
"We can go into it now," I said, "but everything takes a long time in Palatial. There won't be time for you to ride out to the Black Castle before you have to leave."
"I can still look around," the little boy said. "I can still make plans, can't I?"
"Of course," I said. "Make all the plans you like. But it won't make a blind bit of difference in the end."
"Why not?"
"I'm still going to win."